Okay.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Seeing it a second time, do you think that the race thing? Does it make the race thing make sense to you? Still,
I mean. I think it's one of the most refreshingly cathartic films about the racial soup in this country that I've ever seen. My first reaction when I saw it was that the same revelatory atmosphere or aura or aroma that I got from Obama's Philadelphia speech was some of that, a lot of that, is in your film. And I feel that it just talks very plainly and simply, and it drills right into some stuff that I have not gotten from a film.
I'm glad because you know, we really set out to do that. It wasn't by accident.
Yeah.
Kevin and I really set out to, you know, when he was in London and he called me, what had happened was I had written the script, and I had been wanting to write this story for a long time because it was in my life and in my head. And I said to JJ, his manager at the time, who's passed away, I don't know if you saw what we dedicated the movie
to.
JJ
Harris, yeah.
Did you know her?
No, I didn't really know
her. She's a great gal. She was a great gal. But anyway, I said, just read this. I just wrote it. Don't give it to Kevin, but I want to ask you, do you think Kevin would take this on? Because I want to really go for this. I don't want to pull back on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you read it and talk to me. Don't give it to Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
2 days later, she calls me back. She said, I need to talk about your script. And I think, you know, managers never read it that fast. So she calls me. She goes, he's going to call you tonight. I said, oh, you told him about it? He wants to read it? She went, no, he's read it. He wants to do it. He needs to talk to, you. So he called me from London.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of getting ready to say, look, Kevin, I'm not going to pull back. You need to use the N-word. Or you're not. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pull back on the drinking. You know, I want to. And I didn't even get any of that out. He went, you're not touching any of that stuff. Da, da, da. We're going to do this right. I want to really do a great conversation about race in this country. I think you've written something. I think some of those speeches in the courtroom, I feel about them the way I felt about the baseball scenes in Field of Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That he said, when I read Field of Dreams, I thought, no one's ever written about baseball that way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the James Earl Jones speech?
Yeah.
And the Burt Lancaster, he said, and so he goes, that's what I feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
He said, so I'm going to do it if you don't want to fuck with it. And it was bizarre because I was about to give him the opposite speech, you know, because you think, well, any actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you another story. When we did the shoot, the night Paula Deen got into all that trouble.
Yeah.
The next day we were shooting that big scene where he chases him down the street and he calls him a street nigger.
No. Right? He doesn't call him a street nigger. He says, you're acting like, or you don't want to
be. Why don't you quit acting like a little street nigger?
Yeah.
Well.
And he got that scene as it was, we point this out, that term was, you know, there are colloquialisms that people of color can use about themselves, and that's fine, but you can't repeat those colloquialisms if you're white.
Yeah, and by the same token, if you're white and you're yelling at a guy, you really can't even say stop being that.
Yeah, right.
So, a few people on the set, his producer, and a few people said, you better shoot an alternate. And to his thing, I didn't even have to get into it. He went, nope, mm-hmm. nope, I'm not asking him to shoot an alternate. I'm not doing it to him.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way, because if he has it, someone's going to tell him he's got to use it.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and I mean, that's the thing. This was one of those weird things, you know, for me that as I was writing it, I thought, God, this is great, because I've had a lot of thoughts about race the last few years,
mm-hmm.
you know, really strong thoughts that I really have felt. You know, so many...
Just for the record, because just to put this down, the origin of this situation, which is about basically a custody battle between Kevin Costner, who's an attorney, and his grandchild, his daughter is the mom, Reggie, this guy with a drug problem, is the dad, Olivia is the mother, and basically it's a custody issue, but it came from a real place. Can you just go over that one more time for people that...
Well, it was inspired by a real situation. My wife, when we were in our late 20s, her sister was 32 years old. She had a genetic heart thing, and she had a bad blood transfusion, was given AIDS. And she got the AIDS virus, and she died 6 months later. And she had a 7-year-old boy. She had been married to a black man who had just deserted them, wasn't in their life, wasn't in his son's life. And my wife and I and her brother have raised him to this day, you know? And he's still in our life to this day. And
what's he doing now?
He lives in Tampa. He just had the same heart operation that his mother had. This last weekend, my wife's been down in Florida. Wow. And my wife and my daughter have been down in Florida helping him recuperate. But it was a genetic thing.
Right.
But thank God,
right,
he didn't have the bad blood transfusion.
Right. Right.
But he's okay now. He has his own son. So anyway, he also had a family down in South Central, a grandmother who was very much in his life. So he lived with us, but he would visit down there and spend some weekends, and it was another world. And it was a great family. That was one of the one things to me that I always thought, when people see, this is not the type of black family in South Central Los Angeles that you see on television and movies, you know. And at the same time, during that period, my assistant, I had a deal at Disney, and my assistant was a black woman who lived down in South Central, who had 5 kids and was married to a minister, and they had a life nothing like you see depicted, you know. And
what do you mean, the nicer life? What do you mean? How was it not like?
No, I mean it was. They didn't live in a fancy house, but they just they had. They were really together people. They really had a lot of love and a lot of discipline with the kids. And the house, the real woman's name was Grandma Cheek. Mm-hmm. Grandma Chick, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And her house was spotless all the time, you know, impeccable, you know, but small and... you know, overrun by kids.
Right.
But, you know, there was no drugs. She wouldn't have it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And but it truly was another planet than Santa Monica.
Yeah. There's a great third act in your film, which I think is going to be it is the thing that sells it. And there's a great, as Kevin was saying, this is what he liked about it, but there's a great testimony scene at the end, which I think is just liberating. It makes you feel like air is coming into the room. Interesting that at the end, when he says he's going to dry out, he needs some air for a couple of weeks. Isn't that how he says it?
Yeah.
Is that what people who are drying out say?
Right.
Is that an AA term? I need some air in my life?
No.
Something?
No, it's not what he said. He said, I need to learn how to breathe again. I need to learn how to breathe, how people that live normal lives breathe.
Right. Anyway, there's such a cathartic feeling from the third act. And I was saying to you, we were talking earlier, that I think that since we, over the last 3, 4, or 5 days, we've had quite an intense discussion about racial profiling and about how people how about the shitty end of the stick that African Americans get from cops, particularly in small towns like Ferguson, And it's just in the air. It's all over the place. The atmosphere is there. It's very incendiary and kind of, you know, everybody's kind of sensitive, a little angry about it. Some people are really angry, obviously. I think it being in the air, it kind of like feeds into kind of what your film is about in a way.
Well, I understand that, but to me, it's always in the air. It's always in the air. It never leaves the air. That's the thing. Everybody said, oh, now Barack Obama's our president. We're going to go beyond this. We haven't. It's always in the air. It's always in the air. And the only way out of it, we're going to age ourselves out of it, because we're all going to get old and die. And a younger generation who, first of all, so many of them are going to be biracial, you know. And second of all, they've just grown up. They don't judge people by who they are. They judge people by what they do. And that, you know, that's what I told you. I said, President Obama said that about his kids. He said, they're better than Michelle and I. Mm-hmm. And I feel that about my kids. And this is not going to end, because there's, on the white side, there's a whole group of people, our generation and older, and who just have preconceived notions and just don't want to do anything to understand what black people's day-to-day life in this country is. And on the black side, there are people our age and old generation that have no interest in seeing any kind of move or growth or any culpability in their community's youth. And that's some people, not all people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the first thing that I've noticed when I started showing this to black audiences is I was so happy how much they really enjoyed it. And when we did a focus group, because we really wanted to understand the reaction before we finished it, the moderator said, what would be one thing you would say to the filmmaker? And one of the overriding things is, I'm glad this exists. Okay? With the exception of one or two older male journalists or younger male journalists that would be upset about, well, why was this character a drug addict? And why was it? And, you know, and I was like, why would you not want me to, you don't think that's a reality? You don't think that that character exists? And if you admit that it does, which you have to, why wouldn't I be able to, why don't I have the right to depict that? It's honest.
One of the things about that I like particularly about your film is the way the father of the young girl whose custody is being contested is a guy with a problem. His name is Reggie. He's got a crack tendency. He's still dabbling. He's not completely clean. He's not completely past it. And you have told me that in research screenings and screenings for people, African-American journalists and whatnot, they say, well, why do you have to have a, you know, kind of a negative figure there? And it sort of reminds me of the way people are saying it's not fair today, yesterday, for the videotape of Michael Brown. I mean, that's what was going on. He was stealing stuff. I mean, that's who he was. It's honesty. It seems to me that the same kind of honesty that you're serving in this film, you know,
but I'm not on the same page with you as that, because I don't think that they should.
But you said to those people, "What do you want me to do? Have Reggie be a rocket scientist, or what did you say?"
Yeah, so I'd rather him be a nuclear scientist that was too busy to come home for dinner. Hmm. You know, so it's, but
that's straight. That's honest. I mean,
that's straight. That's honest. But you know, I think there's a difference between being honest and trying to tar and feather somebody before they've had their day in court.
You ever look at BET?
Yeah, sure.
Have you noticed that in every single music video, every single thing, everything is about the glory of abundant wealth, and everything is glossy and everything is beautiful. You never see any images that seem to just calm down a little bit and take it easy, with everything being exquisite and everything looking perfect and beautiful. There's nothing that's plain about that station. They gotta have everything. The people that produce BET, everything is like Jesus Christ, man, does everything have to be like a commercial for great clothes and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that. On one level, I understand that. And I think that that serves a good purpose, because I think young viewers of BET need to see, okay, there is another way to live life. There is, you know, you need an aspirational kind of...
But it's neurotic. Everything is so glossy. It's like, you know,
I don't know. I honestly would rather that than the other side, which for years was all these just kind of like thug videos. And girls being portrayed as just hoes, and you know, I'd much rather that. And there's a fine line to it, but and I also think, you know, the shame for me is that there has to be a BET. That's what I think. To me, and I wrote you about this, so I don't know if you remember this, but I think one of the best movies of the year last year was a movie called Best Man Wedding. Do you remember I wrote you about this?
Yeah, you got to cover, get into that, yeah.
If I directed that movie, or a white guy directed that movie, what's the guy's name? I'm blanking on his name because he's one of my favorite filmmakers, who did Jerry Maguire. Cameron Crowe, I'm sorry. If Cameron Crowe had done that movie, he'd have won an Oscar for it. Because with all the music and all the comedy and all the drama together, and the way that guy pieced all those things together, and now I'm blanking on that director's name. But Diane and I went down to see it at the bridge. We were the only white people there, and the way it played, the laughter, the tears, I want to make a movie like that. I want to make a movie that good one day, that where you're laughing your ass off, and then you're crying, and you believe every character, but it's like another planet saw that. They saw that on Bizarro Earth, and we saw that on the Red Earth. You know, does that make any sense to you? Mm-hmm. It's like we saw another version of that, which is, I don't know, this is where I leave you or something. You know, it's like, and so one of the things...
It hasn't come out yet, has it?
No.
This is where I leave you.
Yeah, that's
Have you seen it?
No, but it's based on a great book, the novel, Jonathan Tropper, who's a great writer. But what I'm trying to do is, and one of the things that we were proudest of, is a movie that could play on both Earths, you know, and speak to both Earths, you know? You don't see a lot of movies where... there's black characters and white characters, other than either, you know, a lot of times, you know, and that's the other thing, you know, like they'll make the black guy the president, you know, in every movie now. You know, it's like, I get it, and I understand it, but, you know, or you'll make them like Morgan Freeman, like an old saintly character, you know? But by the same token, I think that it's more interesting to say, okay, these are real people, and Kevin Costner's a flawed guy, and the father's a flawed guy. It's okay. It's okay if everybody's a little flawed.
You know, I was thinking, it's interesting, you're 30 years sober.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner is drunk, or not drunk, he's drinking a lot throughout the entire film. If I were in his position, if I knew that I was being faced with a custody thing, and I knew, of course, in all custody issues, they use everything they can find to denigrate your character, to question your character, I would try and hide it a little bit. I mean, the one smart thing he does is that he gets that really brilliant kid who writes papers and everything to be his driver. Other than that, he's very careless about his drinking. Everybody knows about it. I just thought I love the irony that you're 30 years sober and you got a character who doesn't stop drinking throughout the entire thing. Plus, he's intemperate. He's very intemperate. I mean, he's risking himself. He loves the booze.
Here's the thing. For the first part of the movie, they already know. She's already called him on it in court. So there's no point in it. But then he does get to the point where when he realizes, you know, how messed up that kid is and that he's going to have to clean his act up. And that's, he tries some stupid thing, like he gets talked into learning French, you know, as a as an alternative therapy, learning a new language, which is something that I came from. I read an article about the, written by this guy who didn't want to go through AA, and he came up with all these other ways that people could stop drinking, you know, by keeping their mind totally activated, by constantly learning languages and thinking all the time about new words. Do you know what I mean? And
why didn't he want to go through AA? Did he have the idea of a higher power also?
Yeah, and having to go to those meetings and admitting he was an alcoholic, and he just was trying to come up with ways to stimulate his brain another way besides alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that's where that line with Bill Burr says, come on, you're telling me that AA is not easier than learning that shit? You know?
This is back in the early 90s when I was married. I remember seeing a P.J. O'Rourke comment from one of his books. He said, life would be unbearable without alcohol.
I thought that at one time.
Yeah, and I was saying, boy, you know, I kind of hear that, you know, because given all the grief that I have to go through, all the stress, everything that I have to put, to have a nice, easy, no big deal, not getting bombed, libation or two around 9 p.m., boy, I love that.
Well, I would say the other side of it, too, is, man, even now, 30 years later, Friday afternoon, Friday evening, I would just love sometimes to smoke a fat joint. Uh-huh. And just put a glaze on all weekend, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, at the end of the day, you come home. Because my father, I grew up in Detroit, and my father, he'd come home every day. As he was saying hi, he'd pull the scotch bottle out and pour a glass. It's just, but he wasn't an alcoholic.
I just wish, you know, having been sober now for 2 years and 4 months, I it's no point in thinking about this much, but I really wish that I turned the leaf over and done this, say, maybe 14 years ago rather than 2 years ago. I just would have preferred the life that I probably would have had, you know.
Well, things happen the way they're supposed to.
I know.
You obviously weren't ready to walk away from it.
Because I never had a... you got to the point that you were a mess. I never really had a serious mess. It was frankly vanity, you know, because I thought I looked awful.
Yeah, you told me that.
Because my face was all puffy and everything.
Well, honestly...
When I stopped because of the vanity thing, then I realized all this stuff that was not happening anymore. It was much better. I loved the fucking mornings. Everything was great. You know?
No, I think that all the time. I see guys come in at 55, 60 years old in the meetings that I'm at. And, you know, I was brought to my knees in my early 20s, but... And it was... I had no choice. I was really bad. I was really bad probably from 17 to 24. But what it did was it brought me to my knees, you know? I mean, it brought me to my knees, you know? And to the point where I know that I can't just have a medicinal glass of scotch. I would love it, though. I really, that's the one thing. Probably, I think if I, what's your one wish, you know? Amanda, I could drink like an adult, you know? Because I think that there are people that can just drink
a
little
nice
in a very nice way, and they don't have the cosmetic problems and physical, it doesn't affect them. It's very, actually, I think it's very good on their, relieves stress, it relaxes them. I think it's probably very, in a very moderate way, I think it's a very, very good thing. I think so's marijuana. I think marijuana could be really good for you. I just have had this thing about everything my whole life. Mm-hmm. When I start, I cannot stop mm-hmm. on anything. It's so bizarre. If you and I had a piece of cake right now,
you have another piece.
We'd leave and I would just go somewhere and get ice cream and sugar and I'd just keep eating. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Right. How many times did you rework the script before you... I mean, it is a very well-written script, black and white. How many times did you go over it before you were really happy with it? What's your process on that?
Well, it's different on every script. This one, I would say six or seven. I did six or seven drafts.
Over a period of?
A year. But that's fast for me. I have scripts that I've done 80 drafts of. I have scripts I've been working on for 6-7 years.
Do you read these out loud with anybody when you're working on it, when you're refining?
No.
Really? Doesn't that help sometimes?
Not for me.
Huh.
Not for me.
Because I swear to God, every time I read something aloud of any kind that I'm pretty happy with, right away I see what's wrong with a sentence or a graph. I know it right away.
No, what's really weird for me is if I print it out. If I've been reading on the computer, and then I print it out and I go somewhere like a coffee shop or a park bench and read it, then it's brand new, different to me, and it feels different.
Okay.
But, you know, the thing is...
It's astonishing that some people actually write in longhand.
Yeah, I did for years.
You did?
I did for years. My wife finally just talked me into buying a computer. I wrote for years and I had a typist. I had a woman. I used to pay a lot of money to just keep typing my drafts out for me.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk them out and she would transcribe?
No, I would write them on yellow pads. Oh. I had hundreds of pads filled with yellow pads.
My hand gets rigor mortis if I have to write too much.
Yeah, mine too. I don't write anything anymore. It's weird. When I have to write a personal letter, it's like... I don't think I know how to do cursive anymore. You know, it's just so much computer writing, you know.
I found a composition that I wrote when I was in, I think it was sixth grade, I was about 12 or 11. And the cursive was, every single letter was very nicely composed. Really one of the most legible. Wow. Really impressed. I can't write one sentence.
Cursive's weird, right?
And I have to force myself to write slowly.
Same thing. I used to always write cursive. And so yeah. It's just... And I actually think handwriting is just going to go away.
Yeah. Certainly is my kids.
Oh, and mine too. Yeah. But, my thing is, one of the things that I'm most proud of in my life is that I'm a very disciplined writer. Mm-hmm. I write every day, Monday through Friday,
right.
Unless I'm filming or working. And
you don't write on the weekends, huh?
Sometimes I get up on a Saturday morning and I'll write, and sometimes, hold on, let me just...
Go ahead.
Hey, Diane. Hey. No, it's over. We're just talking now. No, but yeah, absolutely. But then I'll catch up with you. Okay, good.
Sometimes you write on Saturday morning.
Yeah, and sometimes if I'm really on a roll on Sunday, I usually never write on Sunday. Yeah. Hey. It's a butt dial.
Okay.
But that's the thing for me. Like, I've got friends that go to the gym every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't not go because they're afraid that they don't want to get out of... And I thank God. I haven't had... writer's block, or I don't find it to be a chore, but that's just because I've done so much writing, you know. And the downside of it is what happened was I have so many scripts that I'm working on and that don't get made, or so I've really kind of gone more now into, you know, writing a novel. I told you I wrote a novel, and I'm writing a second one, and I'm working on a TV show, and it's just because you just write all this stuff, and there's this kind of feeling that with movies that even if you write a great script, if it isn't made, you've failed. Whereas if you write a great book or you write a great short story or you write, I don't know, it doesn't feel as much a failure. You know what I mean?
You told me you have finished a novel.
I do. It's being published. It comes out in the spring.
In the spring. Just recite it again.
It's called Keep Calm. And it's like a thriller.
Set in London.
Set in London. It's an American who's framed for a bomb that goes off at 10 Downing Street. It's
and
kind of like
it's a London subway bomb, right?
No, it's right. Actually, this is a reverse Day of the Jackal.
All right.
Which is, in the Day of the Jackal, they know there's a Englishman coming in to assassinate de Gaulle.
Right.
And in this, they know that an American did this, and they got to get him before he leaves the country, because they know he was framed. They know somebody put it up to it, and that whoever did that is going to kill him. So there'll be no questions.
So what little I know about book publishing, what does it mean to have something come out in the spring as opposed to the fall? I have this idea that there are the summer books, and then there's the serious books that come out in the fall. Why are they bring? Because they see this as a thriller and a more of a summer book?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it is coming out in the summer. I just know that they're going to have books out for people to read in the spring. So maybe that... I don't know anything about the book business. My thing was, I wrote the book and I thought, if I could get this to whoever represents John Grisham.
Mm-hmm.
So I just cold called the guy, Googled him, who his agent was, and his agent had been his editor at Doubleday, a guy named David Gernert, and has now had become his agent over the years and partner. And I just sent him an email, said, he's like, fine, I've written these movies, I've written a book, would you take a look at it? He said, yeah, I'll take a look at it. And then he called me up on a Saturday morning. He said, I want to represent this thing. I think I can sell it. And he gave me, had me do another draft, and he had some notes and stuff. So obviously he was a guy that steeped in the book business much more than I, and in these type of books. And then he said, okay, I'm going to go out now to publishers. And the following Monday morning was my birthday. He called me early in the morning. He goes, I know you're up early, so I got to talk to you as early as you get up. And I thought, okay, that's got to be a good call, because nobody wants to give you bad news early in the morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've been talking to these publishers all weekend. They want to take it. They read it before anyone else. I gave it to them first, and they want to buy it.
You know, it's funny. When I think of the Mike Blanekart movies, they're always very... are very real and kind of emotional, and they're dramas, but they have a kind of a dramedy feeling at times. If you were to suddenly get a gig to direct this type of thing, that would be an interesting change of pace for you.
Well, that's what I'm going to do next.
You're definitely going to do that.
No, not this. I wrote a script called Disappear.
Oh, okay.
Is which I'm going to make next, which is has a lot of action and a lot. I wouldn't say action like an action movie action, but it's a guy on the run, and there's a lot of physicality and movement, and it's very much a story rather than a dramedy.
What about adapting the book? Is that not?
I'll do that too.
Okay.
But that's this disappears what I'm trying to make next as a movie. And I also wrote this other one for Kevin called Straight Nate, which is an action comedy, which is him and a bunch of young kids that he runs a halfway house, and all these kids, these minority kids that get out of jail and have to come, they're not completely free yet, they have to live in his house for a while. And
that sounds good right away.
It's going to be fun, and he's a guy that used to be a real fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you can draw upon your whole AA thing.
Yeah, and then, but it's like I say, it's an action comedy because something happens that they all got to, basically he's got, him and all these guys are going to jack a jewelry store over the course of a day, you know. And they call him Straight Nate because he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't swear, he doesn't steal, and over the course of the day, everything starts coming. He's swearing, he's smoking. Like, oh shit, And it's a fun character.
Yeah.
It's a fun character for Kevin. And I'm trying to put some action and pace into my stories now. I'm at the point where, you know, to be honest, as a moviegoer, I'm not that interested in just character piece and for me right now.
Done that. Huh?
Well, just
no
for
more
me.
Outside of Angers, no more black and whites after a certain point.
Not right. Well, first of all, nobody wants to make my kind of movies. You know, they don't, because audiences really don't want to see them. They want to see them at home after they've come out. You know? I mean, Upside of Anger did great on DVD.
Is that model, that just means that you have to make it for less if you're working with that model.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, how much less can I make them for? Yeah. You know? And it just in general, people, yeah. I had this movie that I worked on for so hard for so long. I had Richard Gere. I had so, called The Emperor of Michigan. It was a dramedy. It was kind of very much like an Upside of Anger. And I loved it. I was so happy and proud of it, you know. And I couldn't get the financing. I couldn't get, you know. And I had a lot of actors read it and loved it and came, sat right here and talked to me about it and wanted to do it. But it was, you know, I mean, on the financier side, they look at, oh, Mike Binder, you know, he's... movies are kind of dramedies and they're kind of slow, and they may, if he's maybe really lucky, they make $20 million at the box office and another eight foreign, you know, and it's just not what they're looking for.
You're talking about the almost the, you know, I call it the zombie execs. Really, we're only talking about the last 10 years of really intensifying. They just don't want to know about that kind of stuff. They want only the big, broad, you know,
well, they don't want to talk about passion. They don't want to talk about, God, I loved this script. Yeah. These people spoke to me. They don't care. I mean, I'm sorry, Brad Gray, Amy Pascal, this new guy that's the head of Warner Brothers, Alan Horn, every one of them watched Black and White when it was finished and either called me... or called Kevin's, I love this movie. This is an amazing film.
Wouldn't touch it commercially, but said, I love
said,
it.
Said, it's unbelievable. It's so good. But our marketing people think it's a tough sell. And I wanted to go, that's their job.
Yeah.
That's their job. Well, can you imagine any other profession? We go, we're only going to take the easy jobs.
Yeah.
We're only going to take the ones that aren't tough to do.
Mm-hmm.
They don't require a lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it irritated me, so I asked this one guy, the head of production at Paramount, I said, if you love it, and if you're telling me that Brad Gray loved it, and you loved it, and he said, well, because we think if it does really well, really, really well, and we really do a great job, it'll do $50 million. I said, so what? It costs nothing to make.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, we don't want to work that hard for $50 million.
Yeah.
We don't want 10 movies to do $50 million. We want to work really hard on one movie that does $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is everywhere, you know? So these, they really do. But on the other side of it, and I know it's not you because I know you really, I know you have really eclectic taste, and there was a time in my life that I did too. But if I'm going out to the movies, even when I'm going to the Landmark,
mm-hmm.
I don't know why. It's where I'm at in my life. I want something with a little bounce. I don't want to sit there and just... Maybe it's because I can get such good drama on television.
Particularly these days.
Characters and stuff. Maybe because I'm getting such deep kind of slice of life pieces in the novels I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm watching a movie and going out, and Diane and I are going to go out for a movie and a meal... I want to laugh. I want to see a little. I want to chase. You know what I mean? I want it to be a little bit above human day-to-day life. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
And I think that people do too. And as a filmmaker, I want to do that. I want to figure out. I'm not looking ever to do a Marvel movie. I'm not ever looking to do the Expendables. But I would like to kind of You know, I hate to say it, but there's, if anybody ever thinks of me, they think of Mike Binder movie. Oh, you know, he does these nice little kind of character dramas, you know, with that have a lot of comedy in them. Mm-hmm. And I would like to change the perception a little bit and say, you know, he can tell a good story.
Yeah.
He really can tell a good story, because there's a real art to that. You know, and I think that's what it is. It isn't about a bounce. It isn't about, it's just about, I would like to, like, I'm trying to think.
Gordon Willis said the same thing. He said that.
Who?
Gordon Willis, the late Gordon Willis, the late great Gordon
yeah,
Willis.
Yeah, sure.
That people everywhere are just so hungry for good narrative. They love it.
Right. You know? Right. And that's the thing that I liked about Black and White. I was really proud of. It's a strong story. It's not a dramedy. Upside of Anger was a dramedy. Rain Over Me was a dramedy.
Mm-hmm.
Man About Town, I don't know if you ever saw Man About Town. Did you ever see
Man Alfred?
That was a dramedy.
Right.
Okay? That didn't work just because I blew that one. You know, I tried to switch gears to in the middle of the highway. You know what I mean? It wasn't a... I just blew that one. That's one I'd love to reshoot, you know? Because he was good in that movie, actually.
Yeah,
he was really good in that movie, and he's a really good guy. You know, he just, it's funny, after the Oscars, I wrote him a note, and he wrote back, and he said, God, I feel bad because I feel like I fucked your movie over. And I was like, no, that one was me. I wish I could resent you. I wish I could resent you, but that one was me. You know,
most directors they see something they did, and all they see is the mistakes. They say, you know, if I could do this again, it's all right. I mean, you know, a lot of people say that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, but that movie in particular.
Mm.
That movie, but you see, the problem is, here's the problem with that movie. I wrote it for Steven Spielberg. He hired me to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, okay, Steven does this cheaper than everybody else, but he can do this for his normal $60 million and have real, you know, real quality chases. And he didn't do it. And then he was going to have me do it at DreamWorks. And then for whatever reason, they petered out on me. And the people that made Upside of Anger said, we'll let you make this for $14 million, which was still enough money for me, you know. But when you're writing a script that started at $60 million, in terms of how many scenes and big production quality and chase scenes and you know, and you down, it's just, I just didn't have the money to pull. I should have rethought the script.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I shot the script that I had written for Steven Spielberg to have with all the tools that he has available to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but even that is—that's not a real story.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Black and White, don't you think that's a real story?
It's
right?
Definitely. Stories with turns. And I think when you talk about bounce, I don't—I know what you mean about conventionally, you know, a good bounce, a little more than just human drama. But when something really uncovers earth that you feel really needed to be uncovered, it feels good that you have uncovered it. That is a bounce.
Yeah,
you know, the extra fall. Quality realm. That's a bounce in itself, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, listen, when I saw Boyhood, I thought he depicted the later, the teen years so well, and he showed it so well that made it, that was really thrilling to me, you know?
I'd like to ask you an opinion about something that the conventional thing is that if a person has really delivered in a performance, it's a, you know, people start talking about them, they should be... you know, the New York Film Critics give them an award or something, and you know, maybe an Oscar nomination. And people have said that Patricia Arquette's performance in Black and White.
No, in Boyhood.
I'm sorry, Boyhood. It came out Black and White. In Boyhood is so well rendered, and they related to a lot of, you know, some women critics that I know. And I said, well, she is really good, but she's never not been pretty good. The only time that she wasn't good, I felt, was in the John Borman film, where she played a doctor, Beyond Rangoon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't think she was bad in that.
I didn't believe her at all as a physician. Anyway, I said, but it's not just a performance. You relate to the character. You either, if you don't like the character, if she's a problem for you, then I had problems with the way her character was, because her character, in a roundabout way, provides two guys that she marries that abuse her kids, and I felt that it was, I really didn't like her for that. She married two guys with drinking problems.
She had a flaw.
She had a flaw.
Yeah. She kept drinking out of the same bad water.
Yeah.
You know, but that made her. I relate. People are like that. I mean, and By the way, her first husband was no peach. He grew in to be a good man.
Oh yeah, right.
But he started as a fuck up.
Child.
Yeah, you know. So she just, her flaw was she was not good at picking men. But listen, I thought it was a brave performance. I think she probably will get some a run in the Derby just because it's such a unique movie. Mm. And I think also she's so unappealing, not only like you say with her character choices, but just there's one sequence, she's just got this big belly sticking out the whole time, you know? And I thought, that's really brave, you know? I mean, maybe she just had a big belly at that time. Maybe she just had a child or something, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But she used it in a really cool way to play a woman that had, it looked to me that had lost kind of control of herself, you know? I really liked that performance. Mm. I really did. I don't find flaws off-putting in characters. If they feel real to me.
I think inflicting pain on kids is a real problem.
People do it every day, Jeff.
Yeah.
People do it every day, everywhere. You know.
And my ex told me that about my son Dylan. She says, you know, you're not treating him in the right way. And he says, listen, one way or another, father's always going to hurt the kid.
I always say to my son, I said, I don't care how good a father I am, you're going to end up with a therapist telling him what an asshole I am. It's just your journey, you know?
Yeah.
The only thing about Boyhood, I love the movie, and I've seen it twice. That movie, I think, needed a little more bounce. Mm-hmm. But yet at the same time, the lack of it is what made it so unique. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. There's a couple scenes where the kid's driving down the road in the car at different ages.
Yeah.
And in a normal movie, you think, okay, there's an accident coming. And there's going to, you know, something's going to happen that's going to pull everybody together. And after a while in this movie, you get to know the movie so well, you trust, no, they're not going to do anything cheap like that.
I so hate when filmmakers put accidents in, because they know
right,
it's going to jolt you.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is, when your movie... See, I think that movie would have been benefited by being a half hour less or 20 minutes less.
It's 2:39 or something?
Yeah, because mm-hmm. what happens is, mm-hmm. you, it's a lovely movie and a lovely kind of tapestry mm-hmm. that, and you so trust Linklater not to pull shit that your defenses come down completely, and you're not expecting anything but little truths of life. Do you know what I mean? And you actually get ahead of the movie, mm-hmm. or at least you're running alongside of the movie for the last 40 minutes.
Exactly what I felt about Linklater. I really trusted him after a while, and I really liked it more and more.
Yeah, me too. I did too. But I'm just saying, there's a downside to trusting, because I think with a movie like this, with characters like this, you don't want to know everything's going to be okay. You don't want to know that. Does that make any sense? And I just think that I'm just honestly just picking apart what I think is the best movie of the year, probably. I think it's probably going to win Best Picture of the Year, or at least he's going to win Best Director. He should win Best Director.
Nominations are definite.
He should win Best Director. I really do, because I think it's such a bold concept. I honestly don't think he, as a screenwriter, did he. I just wish he'd been a little bit more, or an editor, just a little bit harder on himself. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that movie needs to. And I saw it a second time to just kind of watch it again and let it float over me, and then think about it. And I just feel like I just wish I was coming around the end. I was a little bit. I wasn't as relaxed watching that. A slice of life.
It's funny, we had a conversation about 2 hours ago, and I mentioned, I won't get into this, but I said to you, you know, you should maybe talk about a little fine slicing
right.
in your film, and your response was, listen, it is what it is. This is. I put it in there for reasons that I care. It matters to me, you know, why try and be somebody
else?
Oh,
right,
else,
but the know? Difference is, I'm not telling him to do anything. I'm just saying what I would have done, or my thoughts on the movie. And by the way, the best thing I can tell you about Boyhood is I wish I made it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's always my barometer.
You know, speaking of car crashes, have you seen Luck?
No, what's Luck?
It's Tom Hardy playing a...
Luck, you mean?
L-O-C-K-E.
Yeah, no, is it good?
Yeah. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's all character.
Oh,
it's
I want to see it.
And
yeah, no, I just saw it came up on Amazon.
And it's all in a car, in an SUV. It's all Bluetooth. It's all phone calls. And he sustains it and holds it together because it's, and it's, there's characters. They come in. But it's all about character. It's all about decisions. There's suspense. There's decisions. But it's all in a phone, on a phone,
yeah.
In a car. And it's one of the best things I've seen by far this year. It really requires, and he's wonderful in it. I mean, you know, think of that. He has to keep a movie going, and he holds the whole thing purely on his delivery of the, you know.
No, I'll see it. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what else I saw that I really like.
And you got to see Leviathan.
I heard it's really good, yeah.
It's masterful.
Yeah.
It's one of the great, you know.
It hasn't opened though, right?
No.
You saw it at a press thing?
It'll be, you strike me, you know, like Iñárritu, who goes to Telluride just because he loves that environment. He loves it. You strike me as the kind of guy, William Hurt, I met at Sundance. Why are you here? I just like Sundance. You strike me as the kind of guy who would go to a Sundance festival because he's genuinely, seriously love communing with good stuff.
Yeah.
But you've never done either of those films because you're so busy working on this and that and the other.
The other thing is, here's the other thing. I'm a member of the DGA and the WGA, and they have all these screenings, and it's not that I'm super rich and I don't need to see movies free,
mm-hmm.
but if I'm going to support a movie with my time, I'm going to support a movie with my wallet.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's the thing. I don't have the time or the resources or the energy in my life, and especially the last 5 or 6 years, to just go to Sundance and watch movies. But the fact of the matter...
wonderful indulgence, if you don't have to write about it.
Yeah, I bet.
I've never done it myself, but I envy people that can just go from film to film and just have nothing
I bet,
but pleasure all
but,
day long.
But my thing is, I'd rather just go up to the Landmark and watch it when it comes out and be part of the paying customers. I think that there's too many people watching screeners and seeing movies free in this town.
Yeah.
I think this town... The profit margin and the margin for error on these small movies is so big that if 10,000 people watch a movie on a screener, that's, what is that? That's another $100,000 off the box office.
There's an interesting narrative technique in Leviathan. I really want to hear from you when you see it. We'll end this in a second. There are things, very significant things that happen in Leviathan that are not explicitly shown to you. They are not performed. You don't see, oh, he's having an affair with her. You find it out obliquely, you find it out on the side. He just kind of drops it, but without dramatizing it right in front of you. Really intense things will happen suddenly off screen, and you'll hear about somebody taking a swing at somebody, but you won't see it. Sometimes he does that. I love that he has adopted the idea of not necessarily laying it on the table in front of the audience with each.
Who's
turn
he?
Of the play. Andrei Zinyantsev. It's a tough name.
So he's Lithuanian?
Russian.
He's Russian? Yeah. I thought he was Lithuanian.
And the movie is very, very anti-Putin, and so they're thinking it's probably not going to be submitted as the Russian submission for best foreign language film. If it were, it would totally win, I think, given what I've, well, what little I've seen.
When's it going to come out here?
Well, it's going to be, you know, foreign language doesn't have to come out this calendar year. It could come out, they're probably going to bring it out in January or February, something like that. When, you know,
oh, it doesn't have to, huh?
It's not required. It's the year of release in the country of origin is what matters.
Are you a member of the Academy?
No.
Me neither.
Do you know of any journalists who are invited?
I thought they were. I thought they were.
Be great.
I know. Hey, I've tried to get in three times. They've turned me down each time. Mm-hmm. They just, you know, and then this time I was actually told they're not bringing any white males in.
They want to multiculturalize?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
More women?
Older. They want either, the only white guys that are coming in are younger.
That's because of that LA Times story that came out, what was it, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? That the average Academy person is 62 and a white male.
I know, but it's kind of fucked, if you want to know the truth, from my point of view, you yeah. know, but. But, I don't care. I just, the only reason I really, to be honest, I just would like the screeners.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a little bit of a selfish, it's not like I have a great.
They're not saying no more older guys. They're saying they want to emphasize people of color, people who are women, younger people.
Well, yeah.
They can't be saying, no, you're out because you're over 45 or 50.
Well, it's going to be very hard to get in.
Wow. Okay.
It's going to be very hard to get in and, you know.
It seems a little strict.
Yeah, and plus, you know, it's really not about the quality of your work or anything. You know, they've, you know, they let people in that have made one movie or a short. You know, they just want to grow that multicultural younger base.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I get it. It's just. And like I say, it's not like I want to get in there because I want to be part of the film community and help preserve film. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking it'd be nice to get the screeners.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, mm-hmm. you know, for the most part, if I want to see a movie, I go out and see it.
You know, you've got the incidence, though, of someone who really admires and worships, because most Academy people, they wait for the screeners and then the line goes out, well, they're going to pop that movie in like with 12 Years a Slave. They're going to say, I don't know about this. And they're going to like, that's it. They don't go past the first act. I heard of some people who got screeners for Robert Redford's superb Survival at Sea film, and they popped it after 20 minutes, half hour. I know where this is going.
Yeah.
That's a lazy thing. It's great to see it with an audience.
I totally agree. I totally agree. You know, I mean, the movies I make, they play better with audiences because there's comedy in there that really sometimes is infectious, you know? And but I totally agree with you. When you're sitting home with a screener, phone call comes or this, you stop, and then it's not, the sequence of scenes don't kind of splay out in the right way, so you don't understand them in the way they're supposed to be understood. And it's easy to go, okay, turn it off. And I just, in general, if I'm into seeing a movie, I want to go to the theater. I want to see the trailers. I like that experience, you know. And I also, the other thing I don't like is seeing it at the DGA or the WGA with a bunch of people judging it so harshly, you know, that no. You know, it's like going to see a magic act with a bunch of magicians in the audience. It's a fake bottom. You know? You know, it's like, I want to watch a movie with real people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Do you go to the Landmark?
Sure. I'd like to go there.
It's a great place. I love it.
Sure.
I love it.
They've got excellent sound on top of it. You know, many films I'll see at the Wilshire Screening Room. And I noticed that the sound is not as sharp and clear as it is at the Landmark.
Really sound is everything.
Yeah.
Sound is everything. That's what I learned when I had that screening room in my basement.
Yeah.
I had an amazing sound system,
mm-hmm.
and it made film so good, you know. And then
sure.
better than the theater.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you don't realize it because you think it's all about the picture. It's all about the sound.
Please don't forget about Alicia Witt's play. And speaking of theater.
No, I'm going to try to go. My wife keeps texting me about getting home for this birthday party.
Oh no, of course.
She's going to be there for another few weeks, right?
Until August 29th or something. Yeah.
Did a nice piece on it. They must have been really happy.
Oh, I was delighted with it.
I know.
I want to see it again, actually, where it goes. I'm particularly Amber Tamblyn. She's wonderful. You know, it's one of the best things I can imagine any actress ever doing. And you know, I wish that. You had more of a side thing yourself in doing plays because I love your stuff, and I would love to see people really run with it in a theatrical environment.
I wouldn't know how to start. You know, that's the problem. I wouldn't know how to start with getting plays. Like a guy like Neil LaBute, it's in his blood. He started so young. It's like right now, you know, I don't know if I've told you, but I'm working on this sitcom with all these writers that have been, and it's, I swear to God, Jeff, it's like, I've been playing soccer my whole life, and now I'm on ice skates, and they keep throwing me into the boards and putting a stick in my face, you know? It's hard at my age to be learning with a whole new style of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I would love to write a play. I mean, it's the same thing. Writing a novel, it's brand new. You know, whenever you try something you haven't done before,
yeah, it's great.
It's a lot of fun. I don't even know the path of how do you get a play made or put a play on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think LaBute probably started in college doing plays, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes me want to see the, there's a sequel to this, you know, Reasons to be Pretty. There's a sequel that came out earlier this year in New York.
Oh, really?
Same characters.
Yeah. Are the same actors going to do it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad for Alicia. I'll tell you what, I was on the set the other day. It's after you talked. Did I tell you this? And I started talking to her with Chuck Lorre. And I didn't realize that she, you know, she was in Sybil, one of his early shows.
Okay.
And he adores her.
Hmm. Yeah. I also want to go and support her because I liked her so much. She's doing a musical thing.
Yeah, when are you going to go to that?
Sometime before too long.
Yeah, I'd like to
go to that. Because it's promoted within the, go see Alicia after you. You know,
she takes it really serious, her music. You know, I think she's marrying Ben Folds.
Okay.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
You know who Ben Folds is?